The Oddcast.
Two guys yelling at each other about radio, music, and nonsense. And now, here's Max Tolkoff and Halloran.
Our guest this week...
That's not an intro. An intro is welcome to...
No, I told you, I don't want to do that anymore. Oh. Who cares? Okay. You're coming directly to a show that you know, here are the guys, we don't need to... And there's an intro... So we don't need to go, hi, I'm Max, and hi, I'm Mike. Here's the Oddcast. Do you want to do that?
No.
Can you wait till we're bigger and we have segments?
Just go for it.
Then we can do it when Ted Roman is producing us on a regular basis?
Yes.
All right. So our special guest this week, if there were a Hall of Fame for the format, he would be in it. I would nominate him immediately. There's a Rock Hall of Fame, a Radio Hall of Fame.
If there was an alternative radio
music industry Hall of Fame, I would put him in it.
I would say he actually is the guy that started it because he's the guy that's kept track of everything over the last 50 million years that we've been doing this.
He's not the guy that's just started. Started what?
Started the Hall of Fame? Hall of Fame because he's the guy who actually remembers things that I don't remember because he was present. He was not all fucked up on acid and weed and all that kind of shit. He remembers things.
He remembers
who the pure two were, the pure five, the
Stop
pure
with
seven.
The, we're going to get into that. There is no pure seven,
yes,
eight, anything.
No, that's true. I almost lost my
that is a
job
whole
right
bunch
before
of
I even started.
Shit.
See, he knows more. Introduce the motherfucker.
Right. This week we have, I'm honored to have in our clutches, Ted Volk.
Hello.
Ted Volk nowadays works with Karen Glauber over at Hits Magazine.
Oh, you do? Is that what you do now? I don't
Something that we've been giving him shit for the last 10 years, but apparently it's worked out well. So, there you go.
It's gone well.
Now, the thing about Ted, and don't worry, we're going to get to licking your balls in just a sec for the rest of the show. Ted, a quick brief history, was our local in Boston. I met him when I was at WFNX. And he then became the Geffen National, right?
Correct.
Were you the local?
You were Geffen local?
That's where I started, April of 91.
Right. And he's married to Kelly, who was our A&M local.
Right.
At the time.
And her claim to fame was Sheryl Crow during that era when she became head of marketing at A&M.
Ah. That's why you both moved to...
But actually, even before that, it was funny that you bring that up because I was with Tom Pullman last week, who kind of is the iHeart ruler. And we were talking about when he was at KC101 in New Haven, and Kelly brought a record into him to think about playing. And he goes, oh, I love this. This is like the song of the year. And it was Extremes More Than Words. And they were from Boston. And that actually did turn out to be the song of the year. Yeah. And that made
that
Tom Pullman famous.
That song was More Than Words.
More Than Words.
Now, eventually they move out to L.A. Ted has to work at Geffen out here, and Kelly comes out here as well. And they refuse to go look at a house in Silver Lake. I asked them to come over to the east side many times, and they were very snobby about it. And then wound up on the west side with everybody else in L.A. that comes and moves here, and they want, oh, I like the ocean, or whatever it is. You didn't even want to come to Silver Lake to even look.
Well, that's true. We actually, it was just a couple of miles from where we're at right now. But I'll tell you the reason why that was. That was very simple, because I didn't want to run to anybody I knew on Sundays. I couldn't imagine anything worse.
Good point.
At Gelson's, saying, hey, what's
Phil
going
Costello,
on with... Like John Silva, for example. Hey, Dad, what's going on with my back record? Why are you down spins? On a Sunday, that would be torturous. So I figured there's no chance, if I live in Santa Monica, anybody will find me on a Sunday.
I mean, Silver Lake, before it was Silver Lake, Mike D from the Beastie Boys lived around the block from us. He walked his dog every day past our house. Half a Hole lived on the other side of us.
Half of Hole.
Daniel Lanois lived across the reservoir.
Daniel Lanois. Right.
Max, everybody lived there.
So Ted is
made a very smart decision then, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Ted Volk is known for the greatest thing Ted is known for was being the guy, like the CIA operative on station in Berlin when the wall came down. Ted was the guy on station when Nirvana blew up, and he had to deal with radio from around the country. I mean, this is what you get the award for.
Yeah.
All right, but before we get there, let me call bullshit on something that you wrote here on your little blog regarding us.
Okay.
So you go, when I started out in a record promotion back, well, it was a while ago, I had the good fortune to call on Max Tolkoff and Mike Halloran. Max at the time programmed FNX in Boston. Mike was at 91X San Diego. I sure was intimidated That's bullshit right there. No, you weren't.
Yes, I was.
No, you weren't. Right. For me, this was rushing the fraternity, as these two gents were the rulers of alternative. Again, not true. I don't know where you got that from.
Like,
I don't know who you're trying to blow here. It took a while to gain some respect with them, as I think they enjoyed torturing the new guy trying to get into their pants. Oh, I'm sorry, club. That's not true.
Oh, that is completely
true. Oh, it's so. Were you giving him shit out here in San Diego while I was in Boston?
You have to remember something about Ted. I've always respected him because he never bullshits anybody.
Exactly.
And that's the thing. You don't know this, but you don't. It's almost like you have this not filtered thing where you go, that's the deal.
Here's the thing. As a promotion guy, you're very, very credible. Now, that may not be true. You could be a complete thieving asshole at heart, but you come across as very believable and credible.
There are There are like four or five guys like you
in
the
business.
I'm not going to name them all because then it'll embarrass all the ones who aren't like that.
Right.
No, there's only one other person in that, and that's it. And he's doing real estate now. The only other credible person.
Yeah, they're all doing real estate now except for Ted.
Right. Yes. Over time, I gained some traction, as I am sure it helped being the label guy who worked with Nirvana. Yeah, but okay. As I fast forward, I can't read anymore, obviously. As I fast forward to today, they have started a podcast called The Oddcast. Not That Oddcast, The Oddcast.
ThatOddcast@gmail.com is our email address.
All right. It's really enjoyable to listen to. Again, you're lying, okay? Because that's not... anybody who enjoys this is out of their fucking mind because there are just no rules
for
anything.
Wait till we get the guy who casts Big Brother on. That's going to be fucking really enjoyable.
The one thing about Max and Mike is they will give an unfiltered opinion because they aren't beholden to anyone. Tell that to Wells Fargo. Tell that to the power company. Tell that to my landlord. Let's see. Well, those guys never really held back anyway. We don't have enough of that right now. And to me, it's what we need. Check them out. That's very nice of you to write that.
Yes, thank you
very
much.
Bunch of horseshit.
That's why you're, number one, that's why you're on the show. But the other reason is because we were talking about you the other day. I don't remember who we were talking about. Brian Schock or something. That you were the guy.
Yeah, I heard that
up,
one. That was a good one.
I can't remember which episode it was, but you came up with the concept of the pure something.
Yeah,
I thought it was
12. Marcy's Playground was Brian Schock's big thing when he was at 99.
That was Muckley.
Was that Muckley who did that?
That was Chris, yes.
Yeah, but he was in charge, wasn't he, Brian Schock?
Brian was in charge.
Instead of saying
Muckley.
The word pure, why don't you just say like the OG7? Seven Sisters.
Okay, this is why did you call 11. It, first of all? Why did you call it the pure whatever it was? Because I remember there was like seven originally, and then you upped the number at one point because it got wacky.
Well, the history of alternative really hasn't changed much. I mean, it's really been a concept of a
Is
bunch
that
of...
like a moderate thing than before? The history hasn't changed much. History tends not to change. I'll just
well, no,
point that out.
And for this conversation, it hasn't. It's really been a bunch of people that have helped break a lot of these songs that become famous.
Yeah, but here's what I want to know, because we've never really talked about this. Tell us, at the point that Nirvana just blew up, how weird did your life become? Because you were like everybody else.
No, look,
I
have plenty of great stories when it comes to these conversations. And I guess, for me, I started in records in April of 91, but I failed miserably. I was unemployed for 2 years. I was a substitute school teacher, waiting on tables. I had friends tell me, do not get in the record business. You're wasting your time. Because I left radio. I was in radio for a long time.
Oh, that's why you think that you can program and do a morning show.
Absolutely, without a doubt.
He wants to do a morning show. I think we should,
it'd be
we
a dream.
Should do it.
Ted and I have talked about this numerous times.
He talks about it with everybody who will listen.
He would be able to go on and do 1 week of, this is how we broke Nirvana. And after that, it would get really boring. So what do you think about the weather today in Hartford, Connecticut?
It's too far.
Well,
wait,
91.
I'm stuck in Hartford? Sorry, go ahead.
Let me tell you how I got. Let me tell you how I finally got the job. I was failing miserably, but my wife now, Kelly, she was doing local record repping in Boston. So I was school teaching at this time. But I finally, after failing miserably on many interviews, one guy, Steve Levitt was his name, finally said, I really like you. We're going to come out, bring you out to Los Angeles. So I'm having dinner with a very famous general manager of a particular label, and we're at La Dome. Now, I've never been any Like I was
I'm
like,
sorry, of a particular label. What label was that?
That was Geffen, DGC.
Okay.
And we're at dinner, and he looks at me and goes, "So I've noticed today you haven't been drinking." And I said, "You've only been drinking Sprites. You don't drink?" And I said, "No, I don't really drink." "Oh, okay. What about getting high? You get high?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "You know, like smoke marijuana." I said, "No, I don't do anything like that either." He goes, "All right. I noticed you've been talking about this girl of yours. Do you cheat on her?" And I said, "No." And he goes, "Wow." He pauses. Then he looks at me and says, "And you want to do record promotion?" And and I said, "Yeah."
I said,
"I would love to do record promotion." And then that kind of ended it. I went back. I called Kelly up. I said, "You know what? I don't think I'm going to get a job in record promotion. And I think I'm headed back to radio." But as it turned out, they did hire me the next day.
We have mutual friends who shall remain nameless because that's what the second day is all about. That I was talking to this person, and she was telling me that when she goes out to clubs with bands, and because she's been sober for years, she walks up to the bartender and she goes, especially with the hip-hop band, she goes, "Make it look like there's alcohol in there. If there's alcohol in there, I'm going to kill you. You get a big tip at the end of the night." And every time she goes out, because the bands are like, "Get her another drink," because they're trying to get her out of her mind. And she never, ever, ever has fallen for that because she has the deal, because that's part of your job is basically to be cordial and all this stuff. But your job is not to get messed up yourself, correct?
Absolutely. Look, I almost got fired one time. When I started, because we were at some famous Chinese restaurant in New York, and my boss brought out this big plate of duck. And needless to say, I've never had duck before.
What?
And I wouldn't eat the duck. And he got so furious at me. He goes, "You know, I think I'm going to fire you if you're not going to eat this food." I said, "Dude, I'm not going to eat the food." And but I survived. I survived that as well.
Ted,
there's plenty of these.
Can I say something?
What?
Duck tastes like chicken.
Greasy chicken.
Wait, so you don't like... Wait, you never went to Chef Chang's in Boston and had...
I have been to Chef Chang's.
He comes out and he cuts the duck up at the table.
No.
We give him an applause. Seriously. And he prepares the hoisin sauce and the, you know, the scallions and all that.
So tell me about Nirvana. Okay, so you're school teaching, you do this, you get the job. Your first job in records is in Boston, the local...
For DGC, April of 91. And
were you married to Kelly at the time or no?
No, not yet.
Okay.
But she was the rep for A&M.
But she taught you the ropes, the bullshit ropes. That you
no.
No.
Because you know why? No. Because Kelly's not a bullshitter either. Kelly's another one.
No, Kelly's exceptionally competitive. So no, I was... when you do record promotion, you're kind of just like on your own. You just got to have to go kind of figure it out, and you have to just kind of figure out what works, and you fail a lot. I mean, when you do record promotion, you fail a lot.
Well, yeah, because not every record's going to get out.
Right.
Well,
but the biggest thing that you have to be a politician as a record promoter, right? Because the biggest thing is going into these situations in each market where the politics are insane, because everybody wants the same band. When I wound up at A&M, I've never told this to anybody, there are bands, and I will not name who, in case somebody
wants to. Peter Frampton?
No. There are bands that, if they knew, would come and kill me. But there are bands that I kept out of Boston. A market that I worked in, there are bands I kept out of Boston because I didn't want the war that would develop between Oedipus and FNX.
Yeah, Boston in 91, at least for me, was exceptionally intimidating because of all the record executives were veterans and have been there for a long, long time. And that was really the market where all records start. All started. And the program directors were, like yourself, were very influential. And Oedipus, again, was kind of like, you know, I read about Oedipus in every trade growing up. And so when you meet these people, it's pretty intimidating. And Max was, yes, very intimidating.
No, I was not.
Absolutely. But in reference to Nirvana, April of 91, the first month we went, I was with Mark Case. He was the national at the time. And we went and met Kurt St. Thomas, your music director.
Right.
And
who likes to claim everything about Nirvana. But in the show that we did about Seattle,
right,
Halloran said some things that I knew nothing about that actually put the lie to FNX being really early or first or whatever.
Well, you know what? I think Mike's story was really true. But I think Kurt's as well. I think they just happened in different places.
Well, in those days, this is, you know, pre-serious internet stuff. When Rosie...
John Rosenfelder, yeah.
Rosie worked for you guys, and what was his capacity?
I think back then, he was kind of like what they considered the college rep. And right. that was kind of a big deal back then because we only had a handful of commercial stations still. I mean, you're only talking about, I don't know, Max, how many were there?
Back then?
Yeah.
That counted maybe 12 or 13?
Yeah, it was
the,
right?
pure, the pure what?
So no, that didn't, pure, that didn't God come for it. A while. But the no, but FNX was,
I'm gonna get into that.
FNX was a really, I mean, that was so, a very
so,
big station.
So at the time, pre- super hardcore internet stuff. Rosie, and this is the weird thing that I remember, because Sliver had come out prior on Sub Pop. We're in Seattle.
Yeah.
Bleach had come out prior, and we right. had played those as specialty records on 91X originally. So when we got to Seattle, we already knew about Soundgarden. We knew about the Mudhoneys of the world. So when we got on the air, we played Touch Me, I'm Sick, which I kind of forgot and said, fuck me, I'm rich in the middle of it. So in the middle of the
and
song.
And this is
like,
all in 89, right? 89,
no,
90?
This is because the single for Smells Like Teen Spirit came out when?
September of 91.
August, the end of August, we're launching the end in Seattle. Stapleford and I had been up there for a month or so beforehand, going right. and listening to the market and going through all the bullshit, and decided we're just going to play some of these great Seattle bands. At the time, keep in mind, Nirvana was not the band they became. So Rosie just kind of brought in whatever, it was a burned CD of whatever it was, for Smells Like Teen Spirit. And he goes, hey, it's not coming out for like 3 weeks. We played it in the first hour and a half, I believe, that we were on the air. And then he took it back so that we didn't have a copy of it. We just played it and went, wow, that sounds totally cool. We didn't sit there and go like, this is going to change the world, because nobody knew at that point what was going to happen. But it was slightly after that that things started going to the point where whatever. So when FNX got it and we got it at 91X and K-Rock got it, it became this fucking unbelievable phenomenon.
Yeah.
To the point where my neighbors were going, why aren't you playing this track? Because the album came out shortly thereafter, November.
September 24th, 91.
Okay.
Same day as the Chili Peppers album, which had Under the Bridge.
Right, and they all toured that year. Chili Peppers.
Were you at the big show on New Year's Eve? Consider that like the biggest rock concert.
That was our. That was the 91X New Year's Eve party 2 days before New Year's. Pearl Jam, Nirvana opening for the Chili Peppers. Eddie climbs through the rafters, does his normal stuff. We're trying to interview people afterwards. For some reason, I brought my dog to the show. I don't know why, but I just had to.
Because Buster liked it.
No, it was his pre-Buster.
Oh.
This is Barney. So that would have been great. He would have been 55 now. But the point is that when that record took off, and it happened in such a weird, organic way, and my friends were coming to me and going, like, how come you're not playing In Bloom? How come you're not playing this? I'm like, holy fuck, how do my friends know about these other songs on a record, which to us was just starting to get rolling? But you, inside the business, were probably just watching these sales go tick, 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 to the point where, at what point did you go, like, this is fucking...
I think at Christmas was, I think the USA Today did a big thing about how Nirvana overtook Michael Jackson's album.
Wait a minute, this was 3 months after?
Three months after, I think, yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. But you know
Two
what?
And a half months.
You know, listening October, to that, November, FNX did play a gigantic role in this whole process, too. I remember when we met Kurt that day, and he wanted to have the band play this...
free show.
Well, a radio show, which I think was really novel at the time. I mean, it was almost like unheard of. And he was super insistent on it. He goes, you know, I have to have Nirvana. He was like almost like crazy about it. And Case goes, well, nobody really knows him, and it's a brand new record. He goes, well, you don't understand. And he looked him straight in the eye with complete seriousness, goes, they're going to change the face of music as we know it today.
Kurt said that, right?
Kurt said that moment. And I looked at him and said, don't you think that's a crazy thing to say?
And he said the same thing about Black 47 too, but
no, and this is true, and this is true,
and Candy Flip
in classic Kurt fashion. And if you know him, he goes, "Dude, you don't understand." And needless to say, he was completely right. And then a bunch of different stories. I mean, there's so many great stories. The night before the show,
it was a birthday bash.
It was a birthday bash on Lansdowne Street across
from Fenway.
From Fenway,
right.
And the night before the show, I go and Mark, which is still my favorite dinner I've ever been to.
I think
to.
It's a Nirvana. Pearl Jam is on the bill as well.
You didn't have Pearl Jam.
No,
but
we didn't.
You're close, though. The show at Axis that night was Bullet La Volta, Smashing Pumpkins, and Nirvana, which was pretty insane.
The club holds 700 people.
800
people.
Yeah. You know, bouncing around. That's one of those things where you go to sound check and you don't think anything of it, and you go and watch the bands, and I've been to 1,000 sound checks. when he got up and did the sound check, and everybody's kind of like, they're setting up the bar, everybody's getting the club ready for the night. That was one of the rare times where I'll look back in history, and when he turned the guitar on, y'all just kind of stopped what you were doing. And you said, whoa. But it was a series of that over 3 days. The night before, I had a... there used to be a hotel right across the street from Fenway Park called Howard Johnson's.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and they
yeah.
were that's where they were staying. So we went to pick them up to go have this dinner on a Sunday night. But they said, hey, wait a second. We have to go to the Rathcellar. He wanted to go see his favorite band. It was a band called the Melvins. So I'm with Kelly, and we go there. But we get there late. So we get to the door, and he's a pretty quiet guy, Kurt. He goes, hey, my name's on the guest list. But his name wasn't on the list. So the bouncer wouldn't let us in. And then all of a sudden, it was really kind of strange. Like out of nowhere, this woman comes up, grabs the bouncer's hand, and says, you got to let this guy in this club right now. And the guy goes, well, why do I want to do that? He goes, because this is Jesus Christ, and you better let him in right now. And I look at Kelly, and I said, God, that is just really wild. I mean, that's just truly wild. That woman, by the way, turned out to be Mary Lou Lord, who ended up having pretty much like a 5-year career. I think she got a record deal to Columbia, and I think she dated him for I don't know how long they dated, like a week or two. We get to the club. It's pretty much over. We get there too late. We're walking down the stairs, and then all of a sudden, two kids, I don't know, 20 years old, wearing Nirvana shirts, are walking up. He's walking down the stairs, and again, same exact thing. They look like they just saw Jesus Christ. And you look back again and you say, wow, this is just really strange, because you don't see guys looking at guys in starry eye. That's a pretty unique thing. And right. If you actually ever do see it, especially in the world of music, it's obviously going to be something special. So we get down to the club. We miss the show. We're hanging out at the bar. And then two more kids come up and go to Kurt, goes, you're an ass. And I'm an ass. Why am I an ass? He goes, because I can't go to the show tomorrow night for the FNX show. And he goes, well, why can't you go? Because I'm not 21. They were not 21 years old. And Kurt then looks at Mark and goes, well, we've never done a show for anybody over 21.
They're all under
yeah, age. First, all age. Every yeah, show they did all was ages. All ages. And he goes, well, that's really wrong. We should do something about that. So then they decided at that moment they were going to do another show the next night for all the kids who couldn't get in for the
where
and the FNX
where was
show.
That going to be?
It was the same place. I think they did it like
an access,
I think
it was an all ages access.
Yeah, they did
show.
It like the
all
next right. day. So I remember the day after your show, which was really one of the more famous shows I think that ever happened. I put flyers around the city that day telling people about a free Nirvana show at Axis for anybody who couldn't get in. Only like 300 people came. Not many people even came to that.
By the way, the birthday show, I think Kurt St. Thomas has all the signed posters from that show that remain.
Yeah, there was all this controversy. There used to be a bar next to it called Bill's Bar.
Yep.
And Chris got into some fight with some crazy guy over a flag, and that was kind of blown out of proportion a little bit, but that was just a real crazy couple days. And then the day after the FNX show, I woke him up again. I had a brand new Toyota Corolla I was really proud of, and because I got the job, I had $2 in the bank, and I drove them to Providence in the Corolla to go do a radio interview at WBRU mm-hmm. at the college station. We do the interview, I take him to lunch, he looks at me and goes, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to do that again. I said, do what? He goes, you know, a radio interview. I said, why not? He goes, well, I don't, you know, I just don't really like talking about myself. I said, okay. Which it turned out that was his last radio interview.
Are you sure?
You know, he never did another one.
But wait a minute.
No,
but Kurt St. Thomas did the sit-down interview.
Yeah, but not
that
a live radio interview.
Cut up into the...
Yeah,
the
I know that. Yeah, series. I remember that.
There's a huge difference between on the air, live, not being able to edit or not right. being able to correct something.
Yeah, and then I said to him, if you're not going to do this and
do you remember what month that was?
Yeah, this is like September 25th. This is all like of 91. And then I said, well, why did you sign to DGC if you're not into doing any of these things? I mean, what are you here for? And he goes, well, I just want to be like Sonic Youth. I said, Sonic Youth, no kidding. And he goes, yeah, if I could sell a couple hundred thousand records, everything would be fine. I said, great. And then a couple months later, boom, there you go. So.
And you know, what's funny is that prior, in that fall of 91, there were only 13 alternative stations. 18 months later, there were 36.
Yeah.
18 months later, 36.
Well, the Pearl Jam thing, too, which I know, Mike, you inflated. You have a ton of stories. That record sat around for a while. I mean, before
forever.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. I mean, it was out, if I remember, before it got any traction, well over 6 months.
About 9 months total.
Yeah, there you go.
About 9 months total. And the bizarre thing about it was when the day we launched The End in Seattle was the day they released 10, the Pearl Jam album, and they did the party at the Seattle Center. Kevin and I had gotten postcards from Jack Isquith because I think he was at Epic at the time. I believe Jack was actually in town, if I remember correctly, in Seattle. And these postcards, because it was the Seattle Needle, they were like, you know, 12-inch postcards, maybe like 4 inches wide. And it basically pictured the Seattle Needle that said, you know, join us. And it was Eddie's drawings of the 10 guy, you know, the little man thing. And join us for this thing. And none of us could go because we were launching. We launched a station in the afternoon. I had to jock like the first 2 hours. Then Brian Jones came on the air. And then somebody, and I asked, I had to go back on the air afterwards. And so we couldn't go to this party. About a week or so later, Marco Collins came up and joined us. And Vedder came by to do an interview with Marco, goes on the air with him because at that point Pearl Jam was getting reasonably well known because originally they weren't called Pearl Jam. You remember they were the whole Green River thing. They changed the name to Mookie Blaylock, and then they became Pearl Jam when the album came out because Mookie Blaylock obviously wouldn't.
Yeah, but you're also
name.
Even not even bringing a Mother Love Bone as well. I mean, which,
well, the Love Bone, yeah, Green, yeah. Well, all that. So it was like the amalgamation of these bands. But the insane part for me was that Vedder comes in to do his first interview on The End, and Marco's interviewing him. And he says to Marco, "You're the first guy that ever played my voice on the radio." And Marco goes, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "I was in San Diego. I was in a band called Bad Radio. And you, on loudspeaker, the local music show on 91X, you played this song that I wrote. And I sent you the cassette. And I remember exactly what you said. Because, like, you know, rock stars tend to remember the first thing that said about them on the radio." And Marco said, "That's Bad Radio. The song is whatever it was. And that song was thumping." Marco had these really bizarre expressions. He goes, "That song was thumping." So Eddie's like going, "Oh my God, he thinks my song is thumping." But you gotta remember, Marco's whole thing was to play as many cool local bands as possible. So eventually, Bad Radio ceased to exist. He moved to Seattle because he began getting the cassettes from the Mother Love Bone / Green River, you know, guys. And so when he moved there and we launched the station at the same time, he felt like, "Oh my God, I got somebody on the inside who already knows who the hell I am." And of course, they blew up. Probably about 6-7 months after that, to the point where it was just like two amazing bands from Seattle. One still is going, unfortunately, or is still going, fortunately. And what's insane about it is that, you know, that weird San Diego connection. Because even the Cameron.
Jesus Christ.
I'll turn your mic on.
Well, you know what? We're bouncing.
All right, hang on. Wait. Ted, because you've talked enough. Let's go back to Ted.
I want to know. It's like,
but, you know, Pearl Jam, hold on. You know, it's funny because when you talk about the Nirvana stories, you brought up Rochelle Fox. And with Michael Goldstone, who was the A&R person for Pearl Jam, and then Rochelle and Michael eventually got married.
Originally,
right, and that was my first foray at Geffen. Was Rochelle worked with me in the alternative department, and our first record that Rochelle and I were going to work together was Weezer's The Blue Album, the Sweater Song. That was going to be the first track,
right?
And the record was going to come out in June, and I went to Rochelle, and if you know Rochelle, this is pretty much classic Rochelle. I said, "Rochelle, I know I'm from the Northeast, so I'm conditioned to think that anything that uses the word cold or like a sweater, do not put a song like that on in the summertime, because all the program directors are going to say, I'm not going to play anything like called the Sweater Song in the middle of the summer. I'm never going to do anything like that." So I looked to Rochelle and I say, "Hey, we shouldn't come with this track. I think we should pick something else." And she looks at me and she goes, "Ted, fuck you. We're coming with this track." And that was classic Rochelle. And, you know, it was at the time, it looked like a great decision. And record, I'll never forget it. The record went to like number 6 or 7 on the chart. And I learned about Call Out Research at that moment because the record kind of burned out really badly. And I thought, here I am. I have this new job and I just ruined this young band's career because we didn't come with the right track. And I said, "Oh, this is awful." So then about a month later, they brought me down to the creative department. They watched this new video for the next single, a song called Buddy Holly. And they said, "Well, what do you think of the video?" And I said, "Wow, it's kind of corny." And needless to say, that was the last time I ever made a comment about a video in my whole life because, well, as it turned out, the video came out. And I took the song, we went to K-Rock, and played the song for K-Rock. They put it on the air immediately, and the video turned out to be the video of the year.
Right.
And then during the next 3 or 4 years while I was at Geffen, before every single meeting, they would ask me what I would think of a video.
See, that's interesting. There's a lot of, hang on, there's a lot of...
But Rochelle Fox, though.
There is a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. That's when I was at A&M, we went into these big marketing meetings talking about bands and what are we going to lead with. I dared to give my opinion on something. And if they take your advice, then there's all this pressure on you. You got to deliver because you're the one that stepped out and said, yeah, I think this is the song that'll work at radio. And if you're wrong, you're fucked. They will never ask you anything again.
That's why you need to be an A&R
guy. You just have to be.
Well, you know what?
You're mentioning a lot of really incredible people. Marco Collins, during my time.
We're only blowing you today, so no, just calm down.
But people that are just amazing.
Before we go off on the Marco thing, I want to back you up on the Rochelle thing. Because when Rochelle.
Another amazing person.
But before she worked for you.
Yeah.
Before she worked for you, she worked at Tower Records. She was a programming assistant at 91X, and she got the job at Geffen because Kim White hired her. Kim White brought her up.
Correct.
Yeah. Before that, when she was working at 91X, she was the one that was constantly bitching at me about how come you're not playing Mudhoney? How come you're not playing Soundgarden? How come you're not playing Nirvana? She was the one, and she was a kid. She was not even supposed to be going to bars. She drove to the Casbah the first time Nirvana played there, Bleach era.
Where's that? San Diego? You might want to say that for people that are not aware of the city.
Well, she worked at 91X with me, so she didn't drive to fucking Tucson. So the point was, she drove, picked the band up in her little Ford Escort, and brought them by to be interviewed by Vince Canova.
Another great guy.
So Vince is interviewing Nirvana before Geffen had signed them, before DGC had signed them. And the thing about it was that she took the initiative of doing this. And then eventually they came back and played, right around the time of the release of the album, they played Iguanas down in Tijuana. Max, that's where it is, in Tijuana. So there was things that... So we were already super hip to the fact, because Rochelle basically would berate us. Like, you guys need to play this stuff. Skin Bus, Skin Yard.
All right.
The list of bands that she came up with.
Really?
So when she got the job at Geffen, she was like...
Just stop. Shut up.
The one thing...
We're talking to Ted. We don't want to hear about everything connected to you.
I did. No, hang on.
Let me ask you a question.
Clarifying.
Go ahead.
She has a bigger history than
shut
just...
Shut your pie hole for a sec.
Shut the fuck up.
Theodore.
She was pretty good
in the fall of 91, 13 or so commercial alt stations.
Correct.
Literally... 18 months later, 36. What I want to know, here's the key question about all that. We're not going to, you know, run Nirvana into the ground by talking about it constantly. I want to know how you handled every radio station in the country up your ass when they got huge.
Oh, it was...
Because here's the thing. Your first job, record promotion, you're dealing with the biggest explosion of an artist ever. And whatever happens after that, you've made your career basically on this first giant act.
I didn't make my career on Nirvana. The second...
But I want to know how you dealt with this pressure when they were huge and everybody wanted a piece of them.
I did... A lot of things happened during that era when I was a local in Boston. And the arguments that... Well, the battles that I was involved with BCN and FNX and Oedipus, who's still a very dear friend of mine, who was the program director, that did not go well because FNX was really...
In his eyes, a glorified college station. That's what Eddie thought.
Yeah,
it didn't matter at all.
That's fair, yeah. And there was, again, just a tremendous amount of animosity. It was so bad, I remember back at that moment, that I wasn't allowed to talk about the radio station, because if I did, they were going to fire me again, because it was so intense of what was actually happening in the marketplace. And I remember just trying to get the song played at Top 40 Radio. And I think Sonny Joe White was the program director, another legendary, all these legendary people. And I got lucky. I was able to make my mark on something really special. And then I did get promoted to do national alternative promotion 2 years later, right when the next Nirvana album came out. And when was that? In spring of 93. Does
but
that sound right?
All day long in your office, you must have been getting phone calls from every station in America going, I want them for a show,
The show thing wasn't like it is today, where everybody calls if there's a hot band. No, that didn't really exist. There was only just a few stations doing things like that at the time. So it was really novel. What FNX was doing back during that era was few and far between. HFS... obviously, in which is no longer there in Baltimore. But
I remember seeing you at
thing.
That famous Nirvana show in New York that you flew Kurt and I into. What was it?
Oh, that was a new music seminar.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, okay. That was like I felt bad.
And I remember, so we're there, right? And
yeah. And that was the start of the next album.
Yeah, it was already like a year or so into this whole thing, and you look remarkably calm and collected.
Yeah,
those
conventions are very hard for me because it's like a popularity contest trying to get people like yourself out to your shows or to your dinners. And so there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. And I remember at that particular day, I forget, was it Roseland? I think that's where the show was.
Roseland.
Yeah.
They decided to do a surprise show and nobody knew that it was actually happening. And I know everybody in the R industry from Radio and Records was going to go.
Oh, they knew.
Yeah.
Right? We all knew.
No, not until that time. But I remember, I think it was Jesus Jones. They were really hot at the moment. And they had all the people, when I say all the people, all the record industry, all the radio people were all going to go to that show until they found out that we were doing this thing with Nirvana.
At Roseland.
Yeah. And that was kind of like a surprise show. I remember that night. Yeah. That was a good night.
And one of the last times they played, or no?
That was the launching of the next album.
I don't remember.
Came with Heart Shaped Box was the first track. Yeah. And that was when I actually started. Yeah. But even then, like I said, it was the radio show thing which I know everybody wants to talk about, that hadn't really started yet.
You satisfied now?
Yes.
He was your local. That's why you thought he handled everything.
He trial by fire, right, Ted?
Very
if,
much
if
so.
If you learn your, if you make your bones in Boston, I guess you can kind of go anywhere.
During that time, absolutely. It was really the big deal. And I'll skip over a few of the big FNX BCN stories. But.
No, this is where I get to take over for a second. So now that FNX is long gone and it's a distant memory and Eddie doesn't work there anymore, tell me.
FNX, I will say, I'm not too into nostalgic, but even though that's kind of what we're talking about here right now, I think for the alternative format in general, the loss of FNX is the biggest thing in terms of a bad thing that has ever happened to the format, without a doubt.
Right.
Yeah,
I agree.
No, that's true.
But take me back.
No, that's accurate.
Before, let's go back a little bit, because I know you want to talk about the fact that I kept Smells Like Teen Spirit in nights. Forever.
I want to embarrass you with is like, tell me the outrageous shit that Eddie would say about Tolkoff and the outrageous shit that Tolkoff would say about Eddie when they were competing with each other.
Well, Max just said it. I think he just
no,
said
Eddie,
it.
We were friends.
I know
Eddie
you were,
and
friends.
I were friends.
You were friends with Ted, what's his name, too? What's the guy that programmed KGB?
Oh, Ted Edwards.
Ted Edwards. Ted Woods.
I don't remember them being friends.
But the thing,
you don't remember the famous Bee Farmers trade ad that ran with Ted and I at each other. We staged a picture, yeah, a photograph where he and I are strangling each other. And I think the headline
he's
was...
He's talking about Eddie. You're talking about Eddie.
Oedipus, the program.
Yeah, okay. Oedipus. Yeah. I'm talking about... So tell me a story about like Oedipus calling you going, if you fucking give talk off something... I'm going to take my stock holdings. And
did he say
CBS.
That? Did he ever do that?
What was the look? Eddie's not going to listen to. You know, we'll get if we're lucky. If
he
we
would get
Eddie
very. Oedipus would get very mad at me if I share this story. This is not a because I still do a football.
Okay, we'll change his
football
name.
Pool with him.
We'll just change his name to Rex.
He's a dear friend of mine. We're that week. Well, look when I remember at that time, and nothing's really changed with this conversation. With BCN again was like the bigger radio
Wait,
station.
Hang on. Let me just stop you right there. What? I'm sorry. You got to understand something. At that moment in time, BCN missed the boat on Nirvana and Pearl Jam.
They all did.
They touched this band for a while.
I don't remember, Max. You would know this better than me.
I want to hear the story.
They weren't.
I want to hear the story.
At that moment, they were doing something different. Yeah, they were doing something different.
They were mainstream straight rock. Most mainstream. AOR stations were asleep at the wheel with Nirvana and Pearl Jam. They didn't get it at first.
It
was an alternative thing only for a little while.
I agree. That's why I want to hear the story, because when the band started taking off, they were forced into playing them. Ted is going to tell us the story right now. Rex, we're not going to use his name, Oedipus. We'll just use his last name. He said what?
I remember when we decided to set up the tour with Nirvana to do this FNX show. The show at Axis with Smashing Pumpkins that night.
All right.
My job was to go and tell Oedipus and kind of get permission that we're going to do this for FNX, which you kind of still you still do today. So I went into Oedipus. I said, listen, we got this band Nirvana. If it's okay with you, we're going to, you know, play this show. And at that point, he goes, all right, that's no big deal. That's fine. And he goes, we'll do something with you. We'll do something with my station down the road.
With a live broadcast down the road.
I kind of like, you know, downplayed it to the point of like, you know, it's never, who cares? It's, nobody even knows who this band is.
Three grungy fuckers from Seattle that nobody cares about.
Yeah. And, well, needless to say, when the song came, again, it was just all very magical. And it started to happen. And that week was very chaotic. And I was asking people if we could have the band come by to do some radio interviews. And everybody said no to me. Nobody really wanted them, with the exception of BRU in Providence. And the guy who did metal, he had a metal specialty show at WBCN. His name was Metal Mike. And he let me come by and take the band to go do like an interview there. I said, okay, that's cool. So we do that, and then we do the show, and it's in Boston. It was really incredibly chaotic and just amazing. And then the band blows up. A few months later, I'm in Oedipus's office, and they're still not playing Nirvana because they're still mad and over the whole thing. And he looks at me.
This is what happens.
He looks at me and starts just... And you know what? In a lot of ways, it was really a great experience for me because he actually is just swearing at me for 20 minutes. And I'm 25 years old, and I'm thinking, God, I'm sitting here getting really like torn to bits by this legendary, you know, program director. And then he, after just going off on me for 15 minutes, he said to me, and I bet you gave all the fucking radio IDs to FNX too. And I said, what are you talking about? And he goes, oh, don't be a dick. You know what a radio fucking ID is. And I said, well, you have them. And he goes, well, what do you mean by that? He goes, don't you remember the day that we were here? We had Metal Mike. We came in there and did it. In fact, it's so crazy. You're the only guy in America who has the radio IDs.
What do you say when you explain that to him?
And
sold him on eBay.
No. He looked at me, walked out of his office, never came back. And I was sitting there for like 10 minutes, and I'm thinking to myself, I don't think he's going to come back. And he didn't come back. So I just got up and left, and that was it. And then a few weeks after...
Whatever happened to that guy?
Oedipus? Oh, he's amazing. He's a dear friend of mine.
I'm joking.
Oedipus is just very fortunate to be part of somebody as you know, legendary as he actually is as well. I mean, he's just
quick,
that amazing.
Short story. So a number of years later...
I mean, he broke... I mean, look, the Nirvana thing was just a crazy, crazy thing in reference to what happened and what that station, what BCN was at that particular moment. Oedipus has broke so many countless amount of bands, and it's a true visionary.
So, cut to a number of years later. I'm out here. I'm not in Boston anymore. And I was at a dinner with Lev or somebody, and it was me, Eddie, Lev, a bunch of other people. And I'm sitting next to Oedipus. And, of course, he's ordered one of his famous $300 bottles of wine that somebody's paying for, not us. And I'm actually kind of hammered, and so is Eddie. He's kind of hammered as well, and we're just sitting there. And at some point during the dinner, I lean over kind of drunkenly, and I said to him, so what are you going to do, you know, when you're out of radio? What are you going to do next? What's going to be after this? And he kind of rears back in his chair, and he fixes me with this, like, drunken gaze, and he goes, what are you talking about? The fuck do you mean, what am I going to do? I don't have to do anything. I'm rich. Because Eddie was there when Infinity went public, right, and he got all the stock.
Yeah.
He was there when they bought the stock back, then went public again, and he's accumulated over the years massive amounts of stock in those companies. And, you know, he built a mansion in Athol.
Yeah.
And he has a couple of wolves.
But that radio station, during that moment, up until that time, with what FNX was and what it became, BCN, and again, you talk about people with Stephen Strict and Carter Allen, who were his music people at that time, and the staff that was there, and the morning show, and the famous jocks, and I mean, it's just a legendary station.
I remember Eddie Gordetsky worked there. Do you know who Eddie Gordetsky is? Hang on. For those of you, you should know. Ted Roman should know. Eddie Gordetsky was the guy
that... He played
for
the Boston Bruins.
No. He wrote and helped create and wrote for Two and a Half Men. What else? All these shows that he's famous for writing for. He worked at BCN.
I have a question for both of you guys, because I remember Eddie's reputation when I started doing public radio in Detroit, because Mark Parento, who originally lived in Detroit, had moved to Boston. And
another famous disc jockey.
His ex-wife, Gail, would go, "Do you know Oedipus?" And I'm like, "I've heard the name." But didn't he start on college radio and then get to BCN, or did he start specialty shows on BCN?
Parento, I don't
know. No, not Parento. I'm talking about Eddie. Because Eddie's reputation came across as massive even outside of Boston, because he was doing the underground thing. Him, Carter Allen, because Carter Allen was the guy that, I don't want to say broke YouTube, but broke him definitely in Boston.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Oh, yeah.
I think YouTube and BCN,
but
I think.
Where did Eddie start
that
his
was
career?
If I'm not mistaken, that was kind of like what FNX was for Nirvana, was BCN with U2.
Correct.
Next week, Max and Mike continue their conversation with Ted Volk in part two of the Ted Volk Chronicles on the Oddcast.
Slam the door.